The constitutional crisis in Sri Lanka turns deadly. This is Monday, October 29th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead today, plans to move thousands of Rohingyas to an island encampment are under heavy scrutiny. An invitation to the U.S. president could point to some increased tension between the United States and India. And people in Indonesia are using plastic to pay for a bus ride. And we're not talking about credit cards. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A political crisis in Sri Lanka took a deadly turn Sunday, with one person killed when a sacked cabinet member tried to re-enter his office days after the president removed the prime minister and installed a powerful ally of China in his place. Joining us on VOA Asia is Taylor Dibbert. He's a freelance writer who has spent many years working and living in Sri Lanka. Taylor, thanks for being with us. This is a very complicated story. Can you help us make sense out of it?
There's a dispute over who the actual prime minister of Sri Lanka is. And ideally, this is going to be decided. Of course, this situation is far from ideal, but it could be decided in parliament. It could be decided in court. But there's an element of this that, you know, it's possible some of this stuff could be decided in the street. I mean, it could get very nasty. There could be threats, intimidation, or worse. There's been a coalition government since 2015, which is based upon an alliance between the two main political parties, the Sri Lanka Freedom Party and the United National Party. So on Friday, Sirisena announced that his allies would be leaving the coalition. And he also stated that the country's previous president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, would be appointed prime minister, and that the current prime minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, would no longer be in his post, which is completely unconstitutional. And, I mean, this is absolutely an illegitimate and lawless power grab.
Was there any expectation of these moves?
So I don't think anyone was predicting that this would happen. I mean, it was no secret that the relationship between Sirisena and Wickremesinghe had become increasingly dysfunctional. The government was elected to do various things, ranging from economic reform to anti-corruption to constitutional reform to, they added transitional justice later. I mean, almost none of that has happened, really. It's been a major disappointment. And meanwhile, Rajapaksa, who ruled the country from 2005 to 2015, unexpectedly lost a presidential election in January of 2015. And at that time, or in the weeks before that, Sirisena came out of nowhere to challenge him as this common candidate, claiming that he was going to return the country to some semblance of democracy. And you know, Rajapaksa had really taken things in a very bad and dark direction, and Sirisena had promised to change that. Of course, he's completely, I mean, now, in realigning with Rajapaksa, it kind of shows you that Sirisena probably didn't think he had anywhere else to go.
What's the situation on the ground there now?
I think it's very, I mean, one, the situation is very fluid. I mean, I think, you know, things might look different in 1 day or 2 days or 3 days. It's not clear what's going to happen next, but I think there's a sense of chaos, but there's also a sense of fear, I think, especially like in the north and east, that you know, Mahinda Rajapaksa rules the country. Sirisena has been a disappointment for sure, but he's not the authoritarian that Mahinda Rajapaksa is. So in terms of space for dissent, I mean, that's improved significantly under Sirisena. Reduced authoritarianism is also a lot better. Of course, what Sirisena is doing now is very authoritarian. So I think any context in which Mahinda Rajapaksa is returns to the highest levels of power, whether it's this illegal means, or I know people were concerned about him or one of his allies, potentially his brother, running in the next presidential election and winning. I mean, this is a disaster. It's really negative.
What role does China play in this?
All right, there are two people now saying that they're the prime minister of Sri Lanka. And relatedly, I think a lot of reporting has wanted to focus on the geopolitical angle. I mean, yes, the Chinese are happy if Mahinda Rajapaksa is in power, absolutely. And I think, but I think this is principally a Sri Lankan problem, right? That is probably going to require Sri Lankan solutions.
But China has and continues to play a large role in the country. Is that not correct?
China does play a large role in the country. I mean, China was, I think, Sirisena, one of the things when he campaigned for president was he promised a more balanced foreign policy. And, you know, it's become increasingly clear that there is a limit to how much he can walk back some of what Rajapaksa did in terms of, you know, all these loans that will need to be repaid in the coming years and all these development projects that have already gotten going. So the Chinese do have leverage, but I mean the U.S. and other countries have leverage too. I mean, for example, Sri Lanka has been very happy with this flurry of increased bilateral military cooperation between the U.S. and Sri Lanka, including some military financing. The U.S. government is about to sign a Millennium Challenge Compact with Sri Lanka, which is a major five-year grant, but that's going to need to be re-examined now if this kind of illegal move is allowed to stand.
Taylor Dibbitt, thank you so much for being with us. By the way, Rajapaksa crushed the decades-long Tamil Tiger uprising in Sri Lanka when he was in power, but he's refused to acknowledge abuses committed during that bloody civil war. The U.S. State Department has called on both sides to act in accordance with Sri Lanka's constitution, refrain from violence, and follow due process. You are invited to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at VOAnews.com. Public pressure mounts on Australia's government to remove refugee children detained on the Pacific island of Nauru. Indonesia's anti-graft agency arrests seven people, including a senior executive of a palm oil firm, in connection with a bribery case. The director of the hospital in North Korea that treated an American student who died last year after detention in the country has rejected fresh charges that he died as a result of torture. India prepares to inaugurate the world's tallest statue. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues now. The Bangladesh government is working to turn a muddy, uninhabited island in the Bay of Bengal into a place that can house roughly 100,000 Rohingyas who've sought refuge in the country after fleeing Myanmar following the military crackdown there. But questions remain whether Bashanchar Island will be suitable for so many people to live. VOA's Muazzam Hussein Shakil filed this report from Cox's Bazar, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas have escaped Myanmar into Bangladesh, leaving behind their homes and personal belongings. While they freed themselves from brutal conditions, living in refugee camps in Bangladesh has come with new challenges. With the assistance of the international community, the Bangladesh government is building a housing development in the remote Bashanchar Island. The island, which rose from the sea in 2006, is about an hour boat ride from the mainland and is vulnerable to violent weather. Members of the international community are urging all technical requirements be made to make the island safe before the Rohingya refugees are relocated.
We expect that the United Nations will be making a full technical assessment of the island. I think that as long as the Rohingya have the right to voluntarily participate in this program to move to Bashanchar and that the technical requirements are met, the international community would be supportive. But this is a process that's still under consideration and under study.
Months behind schedule, the development is in its final stages of completion. But most refugees are skeptical about relocating. Some environmentalists warn that a typhoon or any other natural disaster could cause severe damage to the island. But a top Bangladesh official in charge of refugee relief, Mizanur Rahman, says the new housing settlement will provide the Rohingyas with better living conditions.
Eight individual families can live in each side of these cluster homes. Each building will have one community kitchen and community shower facilities. Each kitchen comes with 16 cookers. The kitchens are made of bricks and tin. The walls are made of bricks and the roof is made of tin.
Bangladesh is one of the lowest-lying countries in the world. In the last 50 years, hundreds of thousands of people have died from natural disasters in Bangladesh, particularly in the coastal areas near Bhashanchur Island. For Muazzam Hussein Shakil in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, officials say China plans to provide an unspecified financial grant to Pakistan, while the UAE is actively considering Islamabad's request for a fiscal relief package of up to $6 billion to help that country deal with a looming balance of payments crisis. Pakistan urgently needs foreign currency to shore up its depleting reserves of less than $8 billion. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. An invitation from India to the President of the United States might signify some problems in the relationship between India and the United States. We welcome to VOA Asia Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, what's this all about?
So several months back, as I understand it, the Indian government and Prime Minister Narendra Modi specifically had invited President Trump to go to India in January to join Modi for what is called the Republic Day celebrations in India, which is essentially a big holiday in India where the country celebrates India. And typically India extends an invitation to a foreign guest, a very high-profile foreign guest, to join Modi at a big parade that takes place in which all of India's most powerful weaponry and military equipment is paraded down Main Boulevard. So it's a very prestigious type of invitation. Barack Obama, when he was president of the U.S. Back in 2015, he accepted an invitation from Modi, and he was there for that. And Japan's prime minister, Abe, has been there. So it's a pretty big deal. But then we heard several days ago, as I understand it, the U.S. government essentially said no, that Trump would not be able to go. This has not been confirmed or denied by either the Indian or the American governments. But according to the Indian press, President Trump is unable to attend because it simply is a busy time for his domestic schedule, particularly as this trip would fall right around the time of the State of the Union address, which is in January. So to emphasize, it hasn't yet been, this has not yet been confirmed by the American or the Indian government, so I think that there's good reason to think that Trump indeed will not be going, simply because there's been quite a lot of reports from around India.
A report? What kind of reports? I mean, what is the relationship, as you can see it, between the U.S. and India now in relation to what it has been in the immediate past?
Well, it's interesting because the U.S.-India relationship has really been taking off in a big way, really over the last decade and a half. I go back to you have to go back to the early 1990s when India started liberalizing its economy and opening itself up to the world after being quite close to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But really, over the last 10 or 15 years, the U.S. and India have really moved closer together as they've realized that they both share a very strong interest in counterbalancing the rise of China in Asia. And so during the Obama administration, the relationship grew significantly. And even the beginning of the Trump administration, we saw a lot of forward movement in the U.S.-India relationship. Trump hosted Modi for a visit at the White House soon after Trump took office, which went very well. But then things have changed. I've got to say that there have been some new tension points that have cropped into the relationship, and the main one being that India is close to two countries that the Trump administration is not close to. One is Russia, the other is Iran. India depends on Russia as a key source of arms, and India depends on Iran as a key source of energy, of oil imports. And, of course, the Trump administration has recently passed sanctions on Russia and on Iran. It basically says that it would penalize anyone that tries to do business with Russia and Iran. And that's exactly what the Indians keep doing. And so that's become a really big tension point in the relationship. And there are some that have suggested that perhaps if India had done as the U.S. had asked it to do, let's say if India had decided to stop importing oil from Iran, and if India had stopped deciding to import arms from Russia, neither of which India has done, that perhaps Trump would have been willing to accept this invitation to go to India to meet with Prime Minister Modi in January. I'm not sure if that's the case, but there's something to be said for that. So the bottom line is that the U.S.-India relationship has really enjoyed a lot of forward movement over the last decade or so, and really over the last few years. But over the last few months, it's really hit some major obstacles. And I think at this point, it's really struggling just a bit.
What do you think the possibility is that since neither side has announced any rejection to the invitation, that the Trump administration is kind of using that as a bargaining chip as far as Iran and Russia and India are concerned?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a possibility. Now, of course, it's not too late to think that in not too long from now, there could be some type of formal message or indication from the U.S. government that the trip is not going to happen. But absolutely, I mean, we hear so often that the Trump administration, particularly Trump himself, are transactional types, that they're always looking to make decisions based on deals, and you give me something, I'll give you something. Perhaps that there's an effort to use this whole invitation thing as some type of bargaining chip. But quite frankly, I think that this trip is not going to happen. My own view is that Trump never would have been interested in attending. I should say that when you agree to attend these Republic Day festivities with Prime Minister Modi, it basically entails sitting outside for a number of hours, 6-7 hours. In India, it has some of the worst air pollution in the world. It could be pretty difficult and boring for someone. And President Trump, I think, is not given to wanting to sort of sit outside in bad air quality for a long time. Particularly when he's not in his own country. So I think for purely logistical considerations, it would have been a long shot to assume that Trump would have wanted to do something like this.
Michael Kugelman, South Asia expert for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Coming your way, they're yakking it up in Colorado. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Taiwan's capital over the weekend for the city's annual Gay Pride Parade ahead of referendums next month that will determine whether same-sex marriages will be recognized on the island. In a first for Asia, Taiwan's Constitutional Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage in May of 2017, punctuating a year-long campaign by advocates for gay rights. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. It was reported recently that microplastics, both in the ocean and in the plastic all around us, is finding its way into the human body. But the convenience and affordability of plastic means that for now, the best we can hope for to deal with the problem is to improve recycling efforts. Indonesia's second largest city is trying to do just that by offering free rides on the city's bus system in return for plastic trash. More from VOA's Kevin Enix.
In Surabaya, Indonesia, you can often see people walking to their local bus stop carrying bags of plastic trash. That's because at local bus stations, that trash can be exchanged for bus tickets.
We can reduce trash so it doesn't pile up at home because we just can't bring it here and make good use of it. It's a win-win situation.
Here's how the system works. 10 plastic cups or 5 plastic bottles are good for a 2-hour bus ticket. It doesn't seem like a lot, but the plastic piles up quickly, and every bit helps because Indonesia as a whole has a big plastic problem.
Indonesia is one of the biggest contributors in the world for plastic waste, and through this initiative, we hope to raise public awareness on the environment, especially issues that relate to plastic trash.
All this waste is then separated and auctioned off to recycling companies. The Plastic for Tickets plan is part of an ambitious nationwide initiative called Zero Waste Indonesia 2020. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news alert now from VOA Asia. Shared trade friction with the United States appears to be drawing longtime Asian rivals China and Japan closer, with Chinese President Xi Jinping telling Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Friday that the two countries are sharing more common interests and concerns. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. No one knows for sure when yaks were first domesticated, but it's likely that they were first bred thousands of years ago as beasts of burden for the caravans of Himalayan trade routes. The massive, hairy, ox-like creatures are found in the high mountains of Central Asia, where they provide meat, milk, hides, and labor. But as VOA's Tibetan Service reporter Yeshi Dorje tells us, they are increasingly finding new homes in America's high country. Mil Arcega narrates.
You're more likely to find these long-haired beasts of burden grazing in the highlands of the Tibetan Plateau. But these domesticated yaks have gained a new foothold far from home in Colorado's high country. These American-born yaks are descendants of the first herds brought to American ranches about 30 years ago. Today, they occupy a steadily growing niche in American agriculture.
Yaks are definitely a growing industry in the United States right now. I can't tell you exactly how many yak farms or ranches there are in the United States. IYAC, International Yak Association, does have over 200 members.
Got our first 3 yak we started with, and went from there.
The Petty Ranch started raising yaks in Fairplay, Colorado, 2 decades ago, and for good reason. Danielle Garner says yak meat tastes better than beef, and it's healthier because it has less fat.
Mother's side of the family has a lot of heart issues.
It's been beneficial for her. It's reduced cholesterol.
Oh, yes.
The health benefit for her has been substantial.
We have done studies. We did it through Michigan State University and Silk Air and Company, and we have proven that yak is the only thing actually lowering cholesterol is turkey.
Aside from the health benefits, yaks are also better for the environment because they need less land for grazing than cattle. And their fur is a favorite among designers because it's silkier and more durable than cashmere. For farmers, it's all money in the bank.
Our primary business is selling high-quality breeding stock to other breeders.
Montana rancher Jim Watson started replacing his cattle and bison herds for yaks back in 2003. Since then, he's sold about 500 of them to other ranchers. Besides their meat, these yaks can be used as pack animals for trekking, and some are even sold as pets.
Yaks are much smarter than cattle, and they have richer personalities. You fall in love with them more.
It's their characters. They each have their own individual personality.
Despite their charming demeanor, yak farming has its limits. The animals thrive at higher elevations and colder environments. And at an altitude of 3,000 meters, the Petty Ranch has been an ideal home for these Tibetan newcomers. But as the western sun sets over the Mosquito Mountains of Colorado, some ranch owners remind us that in the land of cattle and buffalo, it's just a dawn of yak farming. For producer Yeshi Dorji in Fairplay, Colorado, Mil Arcega, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day.